Talk a little bit about Korban Pesach and the parsha that's out of order. The Korban Pesach was brought, of course, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and then the people who were tamei complained that they didn't have an opportunity to bring the Korban Pesach, and from this the concept, the option of Pesach Sheni was born. Now there's a little bit of a broken sequence because Sefer Bamidbar already begins in Iyar. You look at the dating in the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'Midbar Sinai be'echad l'chodesh ha'sheni. So the beginning of the Sefer is in Iyar. And now we're back in Nisan, in Baloscha. So Rashi says, Ein muktam u'mukhar b'Torah. We know that sometimes the Torah isn't written chronologically, but there has to be a reason for the broken chronology. What's the reason for the broken chronology? Why do we have the section of counting and flags in the beginning of the Torah, and the section of Korban Pesach, which happened first in Nisan, in the middle of Halacha? So Rashi tells us the sad story that this was the only Korban Pesach Am Yisrael performed in the desert. They obviously experienced Korban Pesach in Mitzrayim. Year number 2 after they left Mitzrayim, they performed Korban Pesach, and for the remaining 38 years, they ignored Korban Pesach. So by placing this parsha, which is chronologically first, which happened in Rosh Chodesh Nisan, at the beginning of Bamidbar, you're implying Am Yisrael's flaw. You're not saying it, but by saying, oh, they brought the Korban Pesach, if they brought it every year, you wouldn't have to record it. If it was routine, you wouldn't be recording it. If you're recording it, it's because you're spotlighting, this was the Korban Pesach they brought in the Midbar, the other Korban Pesachs weren't brought. So the Torah wants to conceal that shame. So instead of launching the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar with the Korban Pesach, which would have been stylistically very appropriate, right? Korban Pesach, we're picking up where we left off. That would have been very the end of Vayikra, and now we have Korbanos. The Torah delays the story of the Korban Pesach because even though it's a glorious story, it contains certain backhanded insults to the Jewish people. So there's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot to think about. First of all, just the statement itself. Then Hashem feels the kavod of Am Yisrael is more important than the chronological and literary integrity of the Torah. Right? You think, okay, but it's a text, it's Hashem's text, this is a divine text. The divine text should keep the chronology, should keep its accuracy. Just because you don't want to say something not nice about someone doesn't mean that you subvert or sabotage the entire divine Torah. The answer is the love that Hashem has for Am Yisrael is, in this case, the higher value, and it overtallies the textual and chronological integrity of the Torah. Without Am Yisrael, there wouldn't be a Torah. So Hashem is saying, I'd rather flip the Torah around and make it non-chronological, non-sequential, just to protect the glory and the honor of the Jewish people, and not to say something which could be seen or at least felt as an insult. Okay? Now, what does get swapped in and said? Okay, so we push off Korban Pesach from the beginning of the Sefer to the end of the Sefer, to the middle of the Sefer. What does get employed as the introduction to Bamidbar, even though it happened second, but it still gets introduced first? The flags. So why the flags? Why that parsha? Why not open Bamidbar with something else in the place that Korban Pesach should have been? The answer is that although the Jewish people didn't bring a Korban Pesach for 38 years in the desert, you can climb into their mind and understand why. Korban Pesach is about being included in Jewish peoplehood, being included in the Jewish nation. Once the decree was given in Parsha Shlach in the middle of year 2, these were people who were about to die. They didn't feel that they were included in the Jewish people. I mean, I'm not excusing not bringing a Korban Pesach. Just because you have a death sentence doesn't mean you can absolve yourself or acquit yourself of mitzvahs. But in their mind, we'll keep putting on tefillin, we'll keep putting on tzitzis, we'll keep Shabbos, we'll keep all these mitzvahs. But Korban Pesach, we're dead men. We're no longer part of the people. We've been expelled. We're social pariahs. I'm not justifying it, but you can climb into their head because they weren't able to identify with their membership through a Korban Pesach. But one level of Jewish identity never disappeared, even after the Chet, and those were the Degalim. Degalim is a more visceral part of Jewish identity, where you feel that you're a Jew, whether you bring a Korban Pesach or not, whether you succeed at ritual or you're not. Today, we have to appreciate Jewish identity in people that isn't expressed in ritual. How many Israelis have you met this year that you feel are so Jewish, and they feel the Judaism so much, and have such a Jewish heart, but for whatever reason, halacha is not something that they're able to express their Judaism through and in this point of history. So there's a message here that on the one hand, we want to protect the honor of the Jewish people and not showcase or highlight their failure in neon lights. We're starting by Midbar, and this is the Sefer which it all goes south. and it all goes south because there's going to be a decree of not entering the land, and they're going to forget to bring a Korban Pesach, and this is the only Korban Pesach. That would be too jarring. That would be too dichotomous. The beginning of the Sefer, there is a Korban Pesach because they feel included. By the end of the Sefer, they feel excluded. That's all happening, but we want to keep that camouflaged. So we camouflage it by inserting the Korban Pesach story in the middle of the Sefer, and you barely notice the inference that they're not bringing other Korban Pesachs. But what we do highlight is that there's something called flags, something called camp, something called family, something called nationhood, and that's going to start, and that's going to take us throughout the entire Sefer, even after Shlach. Even after the terrible decree, you will have nationhood, maybe not expressed through the ritual of Korban Pesach, but you will have nationhood. So it's a very, very, very important Rashi, the shift, not mentioning something embarrassing, and what was included. Okay, let me just find my notes here for a second. I think, as always, my notes disappeared on me. Okay. Now, let's take a little bit, let's take an interesting conversation. We'll go back to the Korban Pesach conversation, but let's shift to Yisrael. So, Moshe is pleading with Yisrael to remain with them. And what does Yisrael say? It says, Ki imel artzi ve'el moladeti eilecha. Yisrael refuses. Yisrael resists. He says, I can't go with you. I need to go home. What does that language sound like? Avram. This is the anti-Avram. Avram is lech lecha, me'artzecha, u'mimoladetcha, el haaretz asher arecha. He can't perform the Avram act of leaving his eretz and his moladeti to the land that they want to go to, that Moshe wants him to go to. And Rashi comments, what does artzi mean? What does moladeti mean? Artzi means, let me find the Rashi here. Artzi, im bishvil nechasai, im bishvil mishpachti, right? I've got family, I've got financial holdings, I can't leave my finances, I can't leave my family. So by inserting this language, we're not contrasting primarily between Yisro and Avram. There's no competition between Yisro and Avram. Avram lived 400 years ago, he made that great decision. Yisro didn't, and maybe he wouldn't have been expected to make that decision. But we are contrasting between Yisro, who isn't traveling from Artzi and Moladeti, to the Jewish people who are traveling from whatever they knew in the past. And as much as they've been promised the land of Eretz Yisrael, and as much as they've been told about it, it wasn't their Eretz and it wasn't their Moladeti. They'd all been born in Egypt. And we see this in the ensuing parshas, how false their nostalgia is for Mitzrayim. But that's what nostalgia does. You miss your homeland, right? Brooklyn is a terrible place to grow up, but I miss it because it gets into your system. It's very hard to leave whatever became yours. So by highlighting this, we're reminding that we had a grandfather who was capable of Lech Lecha Me'artzecha V'Moladetcha, and now Yisro is not capable. However, the descendants of Avram are in the process of leaving from Mitzrayim, and you see how strenuous it is to break away from the fish and to break away from the Avatichim and to break away from the days in Mitzrayim, as painful and as oppressive as those days were. So there's a backhanded compliment to the Jewish people when Yisro says, I can't, and he uses this language, Kimel Artzi Ve'el Moladeti. Okay, let's flip back to the conversation between Moshe and the people who want to bring a Korban Pesach Sheni. Something very interesting happens, and there's a delicate balance between the two. They ask the question of Moshe, and Moshe responds, Vayomer Alehem Moshe, Imdu V'eshma, Ma'itzev Hashem Lachem. Stand. Means don't go anywhere. And let's listen to what Hashem will command. And when you contrast this with another section that will appear in next week's parsha, in the end of Shlach, where Moshe doesn't really know the halacha about the Mekoshesh, what happens to the Mekoshesh until they get the answer from Hashem? What? Put him in jail to find out what will happen. So what's the difference between what's happening in Balaz, so Moshe doesn't know the answer, he says, Imdu v'eshma ma'itzev Hashem lachem, and what's happening there? So Rashi here comments a bit of a dichotomy. The Rashi begins with a compliment to Moshe. Look at Moshe. He's so confident that Hashem will answer him that he doesn't say, go home and I'll call you and have the answer. He says, stay right here. Presses the button. Hashem, what's the answer? Imdu. Just take a second. I'll have an answer in a second. Googles Hashem. What's the answer? Hashem gives the answer immediately. Imdu v'yashma. What does Rashi say? Ketalmud hamuftach l'shmoa mipi rabo. Like a Talmud who is literally so close to the Rebbe that he can expect and demand an immediate answer. Imdu means, I'll take a second. You don't have to sit down. It'll take a second. Ashre yalud isha. What a fortunate person that reached that level. Shekach muftach. Shekolz man shahirotzahi medaber mashrina. It's an incredible image of Moshe Rabbeinu, how close Moshe Rabbeinu was to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But on the other hand, there's a glaring hole in that. If he was so close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, why do you know the answer? Why doesn't he know the answer? There's a bit of a rupture here. On the one hand, this is Moshe's glory. Imdu v'eshma, I have a direct hotline to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can ask him any question. So if you have a direct hotline to Hashem, why does Hashem deliver this information to you? So Rashi continues, he says, well, you're right, Moshe should have had that information. Ro Yehoya Parsha Zuli Amar Moshe. Moshe should have already had that information from Har Sinai, from previous conversations with Hashem. Ella Shetomar Al Yideim Shemegagum Schusai De Zaka. HaKadosh Baruch Hu withheld the information from Moshe, who has a hotline, who is an Israel Akim, who just got finished complimenting, who could say Indu Veshma. HaKadosh Baruch Hu withheld that information in order to allow portions of Torah to emerge from people who seek Torah in a virtuous way. Where else does this happen in Sefer Bamidbar? That there are halachas that Moshe doesn't have? No, it's a lavchad. And then it's called Megalgal and Schus Aydei Zakai. Megalgal and Schus Aydei Zakai doesn't just mean mitzvah grows mitzvah, you do one mitzvah, you get another mitzvah. It means that Hashem wants to create a Torah which isn't just top-down. It isn't just hierarchical, and these are the laws. But when people who are searching earnestly for answers, not cynically for answers, but earnestly for answers, and earnestly for Torah, you can find answers in Torah metaphorically. And it applies today also. In those days, it applied to there were sections in the Torah that were delivered that hadn't been delivered beforehand. Today, metaphorically, it applies. People who come today with a lot of questions. There are two ways to ask questions. One way to ask questions is in a way that's irreverential and disrespectful and subversive, and you see and there's this problem and there's anger and there's contempt and there's cynicism. People want questions, not answers. Sometimes people sincerely want answers, and Torah has the flexibility and the ability to be relevant in every generation and to provide answers. Of course, not every answer will fit the needs of every generation, but there is a give and take. There's a flexibility to Torah that you're seeing here. It's not just the reward. You're good people. So your reward is an ice cream cake. Okay, instead of an ice cream cake, some Torah will be delivered to you. But there's a mechanism and an apparatus whereby human beings come with problems. The daughters of Tzlavchad have halachic impasse. The people of Tameh have halachic impasse. And when the impasse is posed honestly and respectfully, then Torah can flex, as it were. Not like it flex, because this was the delivery of the Torah. The Torah provides solution. And that's the very delicate dilemma that's unfolding here. On the one hand, we want to highlight Moshe's authority, especially because it's about to be questioned so severely, because the end of Balosa is going to be repeated assaults on Moshe's authority. So he has to tell them, Imdu v'yeshma, wait right here. I've got the answers. We don't want Moshe's authority to be in any way diminished or weakened. On the other hand, we're trying to create a paradigm where people who want Torah and are sincerely searching for Torah will be able to be the delivery agents of that Torah, as opposed to what we'll see in a few sections where people don't want Torah and don't want answers and don't want solutions. They want problems with Sabutaba, Misonadin, people that are just carping and complaining. So there's a very delicate dance being played out in Rashi, where Moshe says, Imdu v'yashma, Ma'itzav Hashem lachem. Moshe still has to be maintained as the highest authority, the closest to Hashem, but we're creating a new paradigm to help people adopt her. Okay? So one more minute. We'll just talk about one of the nicknames. Less than a minute. One of the nicknames of Yitro, Rashi says Yisro has two nicknames, because Reuel, who we thought was Yisro, was really Yisro's father. And when the children in Shmos run to Reuel and call him their father, he's really their grandfather. So the two remaining names of Yisro are Yitro and Chovav. Why was he called Yitro, Rashi says? Because he's Yiter Parsha Achas Batar. Because of his coming to the desert, one extra Parsha, and not just a Parsha, but an important Parsha, Parsha of Har Sinai, is called Yitro. What an incredible schus. Why was he called Chovav? So Rashi says, Shechibe Vesatar. What does that mean? He didn't learn Torah. He wasn't a Masvid. He wasn't Yeshiva Bachar. You're going to tell your Reb Chaim. He didn't stay long enough. but he recognized and respected and adored Torah and its purpose. And that's part of the trait we have to rebuild in our community. Obviously, we need more people that learn Torah. We need more people that study Torah. We need more people that teach Torah desperately. But we also need a little bit more people that are mechavev Torah, that love Torah and that respect Torah. And I don't know. Still doing a lot of processing because I've traveled so much over the last month. And when I travel, it's a little self-selecting who's going to come here this year, people who have a certain love for Torah. But I wonder if in Israel, it's more binary. Namely, if in Israel, you either study Torah and you learn Torah and you teach Torah, and it's harder for people who don't study and learn and teach Torah to admire Torah, the Mechabev Torah. Because many Israelis studied in yeshiva, so when you study, the irony is you feel more confident in your own Torah knowledge and therefore less reverential towards people who love the Torah knowledge. Whereas a lot of people in Chutz Lars that I met, even those who don't study Torah, don't know any Torah, there's a chaviv for the Torah. There's an acknowledgement and admiration for Torah, for its values, for the people who study Torah. And you see this in Yisrael, in both sections, obviously. He obviously never studied Torah, but he was mechaviv Torah, and therefore he was called chavav. Okay? Baruch Hashem, prophecies are always coming true, the cry of the baby. Baruch Hashem. And living through Rav Amital's lessons. Okay. Have a good day, everyone. Tomorrow's Brad Bag.